A libertarian acquaintance from Wyoming told me a few weeks ago about a friend of his, the owner of a coal mine near Cheyenne. It was a very small operation, owned and operated exclusively by himself. One day, the state inspector of mines came around and said to the man, "You're in violation of state law. The state law says that any mine owner must have a stretcher in case of an accident." The man thought for a moment and said, "Now why should I have a stretcher, since I'm the sole employee? Who would place me on a stretcher in case I was injured?" That was something of a problem, and the inspector left for a time. But a few weeks later, he and a fellow inspector returned with another reminder. State law says that any person who owns a mine within the state has to have equipment to fight gas that might escape the mine. The miner thought for a moment again. "But this is an open pit mine," he said. "What use would it be for me to have equipment for escaping gas?" The inspector couldn't answer that one either, any more than the first one. But this time he got, if not a reply, at least a rejoinder. "State law says you have to have it. If you don't have this equipment within 30 days, you can expect the worst." Well, our man, being an independent sort, didn't want to pay for something that would be utterly useless to him. And perhaps he couldn't really believe that the whole inquiry was anything but frivolous. So he did nothing. Next month, the inspectors came back. What happened? You guessed it. They closed down his mine. At the present time, he's unemployed. Well, the inspector is an example of what I mean by the bureaucratic temperament, the opposite of what I shall describe as the libertarian temperament. The bureaucrat is supposed to render a service, but usually he's a busybody who renders no service at all, but inhibits the production of goods and services by others. And very often he knows this, but he has to keep doing the things that he does in order to retain his position and show his power. And the power he wields is not, like economic power, the power over nature. It is political power. Power over the lives of other men. You are a pawn on the bureaucrat's chessboard, and as long as you know it, and as long as you dance when he plays the tune, he will permit you to continue to exist on his terms, of course. A former neighbor of mine was renovating his house and had to have the city inspector over to check and approve every detail of the plumbing and wiring, which, of course, he was prohibited by law from doing himself, although he could do it just as well as a plumber or electricians he had to hire. He wanted, among other things, to remove a radiator to a certain corner. The city inspector didn't like this and enumerated the precautions which by law would have to be taken. Later, the prospective tenants, whose tastes were to be satisfied by the change, decided not to move in after all, and so he canceled the changes. When the inspector came again, the homeowner said, "I don't have to put the radiator there after all." And the inspector frowned and said, "Well, it's already written up and approved with the changes that I enumerated." "But you didn't want it there in the first place," said the owner, "and now I don't need it there anymore." And here was the city inspector's final statement. "Put it there anyway. Put it there, call us, and we'll approve the job. Then you can move the radiator back again yourself to where it was before." I could give you dozens, if not hundreds, of other examples of how housing and building inspectors operate, both under the table and above. But I dare say that each of you can think of some of your own. All this, though extremely annoying and wasteful and inefficient and discouraging, is small potatoes compared with one of the most powerful arms of the executive branch of government, the Internal Revenue Service, and what it can do to people, and does. In a way, we all know about the IRS. Each person has his own horror story to tell about it. What most people don't know is that the cases they come across aren't exceptional, but are part of a concerted IRS policy. An IRS order of August 3, 1967 reads in part, quote, "Levy at once on known sources of income, wages, bank accounts, and so on, Seize the assets of the taxpayer, car, home, business, and so on. Make this your first action, unquote. The directive then promises that such efficient work will be rewarded by promotions and other awards. The following case, among countless others, was reported in the Reader's Digest, which of all the popular magazines has been the most assiduous in exposing the techniques of the IRS. A Chicago accountant named McNeil was used to dealing with the IRS, but one of his clients, Container Laboratories, fell $36,000 behind in taxes and went bankrupt. Then IRS assessed McNeil personally for the taxes owed. He presented proof that he had no power to pay the corporation's taxes nor control any of its affairs. The IRS then demanded a compromise payment, but he wouldn't give in. Meanwhile, IRS put liens on all his bank accounts and placarded his house with signs, "Keep out, property of the U.S. government." It also spread word in Chicago financial circles that McNeil was delinquent on his income taxes, something that could be fatal to an accountant's reputation. The whole system of credit and good reputation that he had developed throughout his life was now teetering. It took 4 years before the case came to court. And the court, to its credit, decided that McNeil owed the IRS not 1 cent, and never had. But meanwhile, he had had legal bills amounting to $15,000. He had lost much business. Many people still didn't trust him, and his credit was ruined. Though he was now over 60 years old, he had to start all over again. In dealing with the IRS, you are guilty until proven innocent. You must prove that the report you file is true. They don't have to prove that it's false. You have no right to a jury trial in a case before the tax court. Its judges are themselves IRS employees. And when the defendant appeals to his constitutional rights, they quite regularly declare this inadmissible. IRS can seize your property without notice and without a court order. That is, you have no due process of law. IRS writes its own rules and regulations, though according to the Constitution, only the Congress has the power to tax. But IRS officials simply publish edicts which can bankrupt you if you happen to be on the receiving end of one of them. In fact, the results of their proceedings usually aren't published. You are denied the right to learn of tax court rulings that might favorably affect your own case. Of more than 30,000 cases decided every year, more than 29,000 are declared secret, since the IRS doesn't want you to benefit from any rulings that may have been made in other cases. And Congress has now enacted a law curtailing the right of private creditors to attach earnings, and yet the IRS tries to seize the salaries and property of almost 1 million people every year. The IRS, of course, as everyone knows, is hungry for loot and will take it under any conditions. What is not so well known is that other departments of the government monopoly, even those that the average citizen believes are serving him, are far more interested in preserving their own power. A recent book by two Columbia University professors, Piven and Clovis, Regulating the Poor, demonstrates, I think, beyond reasonable doubt that the entire welfare system is a huge racket, paid for largely by the poor themselves, whose aim is to sustain the bureaucracy in its position of constantly expanding monopolistic power over the lives of others. This is far too large an issue to embark on here, but let me quote just a brief sample from my own book, Libertarianism, page 309. Quote, many individuals must have passed through block after block of slum tenements in our cities, cursed by urban blight, and asked themselves, why? The question is indeed appropriate. There are plenty of people in the building trades who would gladly build low-cost urban housing. There are plenty of architects who would be happy to design such housing. And there are plenty of men ready and waiting now to take on such employment. There are also many who have the money to invest in such ventures, but as things are now, they won't touch it. Why not? Is it cruelty, greed, insensitivity to the plight of the poor? It is the heavy hand of government which stops them in 1,000 different ways that permeate the whole economy. There are the artificially high prices of materials, the result of subsidies and taxes and other government interventions in the economy. There are the ruinously high property taxes which make any new enterprise chancy, taking years to break even if it ever does. taxes which mount dizzily whenever one wants to improve the condition of his property. There are further the taxes on income, which eat away one's profits if one has any at all. There is the tax-free competition from the government, which is itself in the building business. There is the constant harassment from government officials in the form of impossibly idealistic building and housing codes, as a result of which one simply ends up bribing the officials, an additional cost. And there is the fact that many tenants who could otherwise afford to live in new buildings can't do so because of their high taxation, and so on. Without these endless interventions, the cities would never have become rows of slums. If the interventions ceased tomorrow, the cities could begin to be habitable again. Unquote. To illustrate this dramatically, let me use one further example from Dr. Murray Rothbard's recent book, From a New Liberty. Quote, consider the case of the neurosurgeon Dr. Thomas Matthew, founder of the Black Self-Help Organization. In the mid-1960s, Dr. Matthew, over the opposition of the New York City government, established a successful interracial hospital in the Black section of Jamaica in Queens. But he soon found that public transportation in Jamaica was so abysmal, the transportation service was totally inadequate for the hospital's patients and staff. Finding bus service inadequate, he purchased a few buses himself and established a bus service in Jamaica, service that was regular, efficient, and successful. The problem was that he didn't have a city license to operate a bus line. That privilege is reserved to the inefficient but protected monopolies. The ingenious Dr. Matthew, discovering that the city did not allow any unlicensed buses to charge fares, made his bus service free, except that any riders who wished could buy a 25-cent company bond instead whenever they rode the buses. So successful was the Matthew bus service that he proceeded to establish another bus line in Harlem. But it was at this point, in early 1968, that the New York City government took fright and cracked down. The government went to court and put both bus lines out of business for operating without licenses. Unquote. Now, do you know what it is, in a nutshell, that all libertarians have in common? It's that the things I've just described make them mad as hell. Whether it's the city bureaucracy that tells you what you may and may not do with your own property and specifies the conditions under which you may start a business, or the federal bureaucracy that simply confiscates the fruits of your labor without consent, the response of libertarians is the same. It is outrage, seething indignation by the people who want to make it on their own against another group that has the political power to keep them from doing it. Whether their orders are useful at all is of the least importance to the bureaucrats. That their actions simply are a monkey wrench thrown into the machinery of the free market would probably be acknowledged by many or most of them, at least those who know what the phrase free market means. Some of them even realize dimly that if this keeps up and increases, the incentive to work and produce will decline so far that everyone will end up in a state of poverty with nothing left for the distributors to distribute. But they really don't care about that either, as long as it comes after they're gone. Let's have our power orgy now and after that the deluge. There is, after all, plenty of historical precedent for such an attitude. That's the way the Romans bureaucrats thought as they tightened the vice around the farmers and merchants in the year 400 A.D. They had their day of power, didn't they? They strangled the efforts of the productive people so that in the end it didn't pay them to produce anymore. Of course, in the end, the bureaucrats, who depended for their very lives on the productive people, went down the whirlpool, too. Yes, but it took the productive people along with them. And perhaps for them, that was reward enough. They knew that it was the one or the other, and perhaps they didn't too much mind if it was both of them that went down the drain back into barbarism. But that's where we come in, for that's exactly where our government is leading us now. And it is primarily the libertarians who are leading a determined and unrelenting fight against it. Have you perhaps wondered why fewer new kinds of pharmaceutical products and miracle drugs have come out on the market in recent years? I mean new products, not just minor variations of old ones. The FDA has regulated it to the point that it's not worthwhile trying to get a new product on the market anymore. It's just too chancy trying to get it through the government bureaus. The libertarian temperament has crossed swords with the bureaucratic temperament, and at the moment, the bureaucrat has the power. So the losers are you and I, and whoever may be struck down by diseases, including the bureaucrat himself. He has his arguments, of course, and he makes sure that everyone knows about them, the chief one being the thalidomide case. See what would have happened in the United States if someone in the FDA hadn't checked that drug, he says. True, though other means than government agencies might have done as well or better. But what about the hundreds of diseases for which you have no cure today, although a cure has been devised, because the FDA is sitting on it and won't permit its use? They won't even let you take your chances with a cure that's still in the testing stage. Instead of letting you make up your own mind, they prefer to make up your mind for you. They would rather just let you die and then argue afterwards that the cure was not yet adequately tested and it might not have saved you anyway. One result is that the only cure for arthritis is now coming from all places, Yugoslavia. That is, those who desperately needed it for a highly painful condition can get it past the customs and smuggle it in. And what do you tell the cancer patient who has been dismissed as incurable by a legion of physicians, but who did get relief, perhaps only temporary, but perhaps not, from a drug that is no longer obtainable because it has been outlawed by the FDA, its laboratories raided by the federal agents, and the manufacturers thrown into prison? And then there is the case of the libertarian from Illinois, who in 1 week while vacationing in the Virgin Islands recently met three enterprising men from different countries. One of them was a manufacturer from England. With increasing taxes, increasing regulations, and increasing labor costs from an increasingly irresponsible labor force, he simply gave up. With so many rules to follow and such high taxes, it got to be too chancy whether he could meet each payroll as it came along. It wasn't that he was outmaneuvered by his competition. There was scarcely any competition at all in the screen encasement business. His enemy was not the competition, but the government. Even though the commodity he manufactured was essential, the government taxed him over 50% just on income from his sales. And if his labor force went on strike for higher wages that he couldn't afford to give them, or if the product was so badly put together that he lost overseas sales and couldn't meet his payroll, well, that was just too bad. The government bureaucracy still treated him as if he were a threat to society instead of someone involved in the vital task of production. Well, he was a bit financially ahead from years back, so he just saw the handwriting on the wall and gave up. He sold his factory to an American, who then belatedly saw what he was getting into and closed it down the next month. There was no lack of demand for the products, but under the conditions imposed by government, it was no longer worthwhile to produce them. The second man to seek surcease in the Virgin Islands was a man from, of all places, West Germany, where there is still more efficient productive work going on than in most places of the world. But he saw the taxes increasing and the bureaucratic meddling growing by leaps and bounds, and the increase in Social Security benefits and the church tax that is taken out of every employee's pay, partly at the expense of the employer, and he decided to get out while he was still ahead. He dismissed his hundreds of employees, he took what money he had out of the country, and he went to the West Indies. The third man was from the People's Republic of Chile. His specialty was low-cost housing, something of which there was and is desperate need in Chile. But the socialist Allende government had regulated him to the point that he could no longer profitably conduct his business. Not only was he harassed to death by regulations, but they wanted him to work simply as an employee of government, for the welfare of the people, they said. They wanted him to do the planning and the work, with the rewards and the praises going to the socialist government that would eventually ruin him or even have him shot after it had used up his efforts. So he saw the handwriting on the wall, too, and he got out. And he just barely did get out, with little more than his skin. All the possessions he had earned and accumulated through years of meeting the consumers' demands, he had to leave in Chile, as they were confiscated by the government. He came from Chile to the Virgin Islands with just enough to live on for a short time, and he now makes a living renting out fishing boats, waiting to see whether the universal madness that is settling over mankind and the world will continue. Here, I couldn't help thinking when I heard this story, our Hank Reardon, Ragnar Danneskiold, and Francisco D'Anconia, marking time till the world either collapses in the togetherness of total destitution or stops biting the hand that feeds it. Probably not one of these three men I described would have classed themselves as libertarians. They might never even have heard the word. At any rate, they had never thought through its principles, nor read a single book on ethics or political philosophy. They left to others the task of articulating their attitudes. but the temperament was all there, and they were what I would call gut libertarians. Who are the people of libertarian temperament? Some are rich, most are relatively poor. This by itself makes no difference. But they are the people who don't want to be beholden to anyone else, and who don't want anyone else to be beholden to them either. They want to retain total control over their lives and destinies. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. They will take enormous risks to live up to this precept, provided that they have to deal only with reality, with the laws of nature, in the calculation of their prospects for the future. But if there is interposed between themselves and their goals other human beings who sit in positions of power over their lives, who by the signing of a name to a piece of paper can wreck their plans and dreams of years or rob them of what they have earned, then they will take just so much and they will begin to fight back at their oppressors. They don't want to oppress anyone, but they don't want to be oppressed either. And when someone does try to oppress them, it first strikes them as unnatural, something not to be believed, something to be explained away as not really what it seems, not really meant. You can't be serious. But then once they're finally disabused of this delusion, once they see the true malevolence of their opponent, they will rise in righteous wrath and fight him to the end. When they say that you own your life and that nobody else owns yours, with all that this implies, they really mean it, and that is what their enemies do not understand and fail to count on. It was just a couple of months ago that I flew to Alaska on the invitation of the Alaska Libertarian Party to give the keynote speech at their state convention and render whatever assistance I could in framing their platform, though they were so competent that no assistance from me was needed. I had campaigned in other states and even happened to be present at several prior state conventions, but I had never run into anything quite like this. Here was a bunch of pioneers who had come to Alaska precisely because they did have the libertarian temperament and were determined not to let government controls wreck their plans, as they were already doing in what the Alaskans call the lower 48. They're willing to endure the rigors of climate and the hostility of nature in order to recapture their freedom. But increasingly, the economy of Alaska has become choked in bureaucratic regulation and bungling. Here is the potentially wealthiest state of the Union, which is now a financial dependency of the rest of the nation, a kind of huge welfare state. There are billions of gallons of oil under their land, yet they are required to import oil in tankers from the lower 48, at several times what it costs down here. Over 90% of the land of Alaska is owned by the federal government. Homesteading has become difficult and hedged with endless annoying regulations, and possible at all in only a very few remaining and not very desirable areas. Even a person who wants to go out and pan for gold is subject to strict and detailed regulation, enough to deter everyone but the most determined prospectors. And, oh yes, the U.S. Department of Interior, in cooperation with the Department of HEW, also decided that it knew what was best for the Eskimos better than the Eskimos knew it themselves. And so they lured them out of the hinterlands and put them on welfare. And now as you visit Nome and Kotzebue and outlying Eskimo villages, you find that they live in little tin shanties, pretty thoroughly snockered every day in the week on liquor, which they buy with their welfare checks, paid for by you and me. They have now lost their ability to survive in the wilds. They've even abandoned most of their native arts and crafts. After all, they get their welfare checks, don't they? And why should they create anything when they can be soused all the time courtesy of the U.S. government? At least the Russians, when they Sovietized the far east of Siberia, provided incentives for growing and herding reindeer and encouraged the native cultures. They didn't interfere with the lives of the Siberian Eskimos nearly as much as the United States has interfered with the lives of the Alaskan Eskimos. When we go in for welfare, we're bulls in a china shop. We always bollocks up the job. Thomas Jefferson was right when he said that if the American Republic ever turned into a democracy, with the people vying with each other for the use of funds for the public treasury, the United States would become the most corrupt, the most inefficient, the most tyrannical bureaucracy on the face of the globe. Anyway, the libertarians who went to Alaska are now outraged at what they found there, and find more and more with every passing month. While I was there, the United States court decision came down vetoing the Alaska pipeline, on which their hope of self-sufficiency largely depended. To show how powerfully they feel about this, let me mention that I had the opportunity one morning at 30 below zero to take a ride in a sleigh drawn by 8 Alaskan dogs. I didn't want to miss the experience, but when the farmer had the dogs hitched to the sleigh, he asked me, "Are you a member of the Sierra Club?" Somewhat puzzled, I said, "No." "Are you a member of the Whole Earth Movement?" "No," I said. "Fine," he beamed. "I'll be happy to give you a ride, free of charge." The two organizations he mentioned were the principal opponents of the Alaska pipeline. And his reaction was in no way unusual. Alaskans by the thousands are doing the slow burn on what the federal government is doing to them, dampening their own creative efforts and gradually making them wards of the state. The moment the pipeline decision came in, Alaskans signed up by the hundreds to launch a move for Alaska to secede from the Union. Years ago, they had thought that statehood would be an advantage, but now they realize that the Great Father Protector has turned into a Big Brother Manager whose appetite for power over their lives is insatiable, and now they are determined to stop it. As I told them on television before I left, even if libertarianism should die out everywhere else in the United States, it won't die in Alaska. These pioneers of the 70s are too imbued with the libertarian temperament to let it die. They know that it's either or, their survival or that of the bureaucracy. And I think most of the bureaucrats know it. The question is whether the rest of us libertarians know it.
This is the end of side one. Do not fast forward your cassette. At this point, simply turn the cassette over to play side two.